Oh, hey gang, Kevin Strange here.
Jeremy Daniels.
And we're here to talk about April's Patreon bullshit. Right now, you can get Cotton Candy in full, my infamous weird sex novella in full right now at Patreon for only $1 ad-free in its entirety. An hour and a half long audiobook right now.
Of gangbang sweetness.
Of gangbang sweetness. You can also get Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms of Ik in full, commercial free. Make humans. Jorek and the Shoggoth steal.
Humans Under the Bed.
And you can get Humans Under the Bed. All right now. For $1. You can listen. You can literally pay $1 and download all of those audiobooks to your hard drive. For just $1 on patreon.com/KevinTheStrange. Gang, get on that shit.
Boop. Hey, Kevin. What do you want to do about this podcast intro?
For Reading to Strangers?
Yeah.
I always think we'd download this broody-ass music, like, blah, 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 and then you'd be like, read to strangers. I'd be like, I don't want to read to strangers. I'd be like, read to strangers. I'd be like, I don't want to read to strangers. Then I shoot myself in the head. Pow!
See, I was thinking more like Reading Rainbow's theme song.
Like, with LeVar Burton?
Yeah.
Like, take a look, it's in a book, that shit?
Yeah, but like, reading to strangers.
Reading to strangers. Reading to strangers. No, that's a terrible idea. Hey gang, we're back.
Yay!
Another episode of Reading Strangers.
Yeah, actually, like right before it actually comes out, so we're not talking about recording shit that we already recorded.
Yeah, we haven't done a show this close to air in about a month.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
So current events are actually going to be talked about here on this episode. A lot of current events. Jeremy Daniels.
That's us.
Get back on social media.
I noticed.
I've been accused of being on a rampage. Social media rampage.
I would assume that, you know, more sensitive folks would consider that a rampage.
So we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
But I want to start this episode with a quote. I've recently been reading an author named Jim Goad, G-O-A-D.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out there's been a Kevin Strange in the writing community for a long, long time. This guy's been writing since the 80s. He hates everybody.
Actual Kevin Strange, like the guy that writes
science books? Like I said, this guy's name is Jim Goad.
Okay, Jim Goad.
He hates everybody, and he hates everything. And he's been railing against popular culture for decades upon decades. And he is brilliant at it. I recently bought one of his books called The New Church Ladies, where he just eviscerates social justice culture in like 35 different essays.
Mm-hmm. We talked about church ladies.
Over and over again. So here's a quote that I think is pertinent to my career as a whole, but especially this quote-unquote social media rampage that I've been on for the last several weeks. So this is from the jacket of Jim Goad's book, The Headache Factory: True Tales of Online Obsession and Madness. And this is a book where he just talks about his fans. Right. And all the crazy people that follow him all over the world. And the quote is, notorious underground author Jim Goad describes himself as a lowly neutrino in the vast universe of celebrity. Yet he attracts a certain breed of demented fan that treats him as if he's the second coming of Christ. That is, until they feel he's somehow snubbed them, at which point he transforms into Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And that quote really struck a nerve with me, because my entire career, going all the way back to being a filmmaker, hell, going all the way back to high school, when I would have these... is that the air conditioner?
Yeah.
I would have these kids in high school that would sort of flock to me. It was sort of, you remember Raven's Flock from the old WCW wrestling days? People would follow me around high school like that, until the moment that, so I'm railing against whatever popular culture is. I've got all these extreme views, these really scathing opinions, strong opinions and beliefs about things. And that was all great. These people love that I'm so open-minded and outspoken until I talk about the thing they like.
Yeah.
And then they fucking hate me.
Yeah.
They never want to talk to me again. I'm a piece of shit. I've always been stupid. Not a thing that I've ever said has been right or
basic
correct.
Basic human behavior.
Because I finally touched a nerve on the one thing that they identify with. Yeah. As though all those other things were open game because they agreed with me. But the moment they disagree with me, fuck me for life. That has followed me my entire fucking life. And you've seen it firsthand. People that follow me like fucking disciples until the day they don't anymore. And then I am the worst human being that's ever fucking lived and will continue to be the worst fucking human being that's ever lived for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So that Jim Goad quote really spoke to me because people treat him the same way.
Oh.
And I've been seeing it, you know, I one of the reasons that I had to escape social media and spent 4 months off of social media, one of the reasons it drives me crazy where it doesn't drive people like you crazy. It doesn't drive normal people crazy. Normal people use... We had a conversation off the air a couple days ago where you talked about social media as just the new newspaper. Everybody gets the newspaper. Everybody reads the newspaper. It's never been a newspaper for me. It has always been this fight to maintain any kind of consistent audience or fan base. The only reason I'm there is because I have art to promote. The only reason I'm there is to promote movies, promote books, promote convention appearances, promote the podcasts.
Promote a rap career.
The only promote a rap. That was before social media. I don't think MySpace was around when I was a rap.
I'm talking about now. Trying to get that 16 bars in.
So for me, literally the only reason I'm there is to try to tell people about the shit I have for sale or whatever. This stuff's free. My art. Just trying to say, here's my art. And it is impossible for me to keep any amount of people around for any considerable amount of time because I piss everybody off in the end because I'm completely honest with my views, honest with myself about my views. When something pisses me off, I talk about it, and I talk about it with a sharp tongue. And inevitably, I'm going to get around to the thing that pisses you off. I don't mean you as an individual. I mean you as the royal you. The audience, the human beings on this planet. I will eventually get around.
You pointed at me, though.
To striking a nerve. I'm actually like karate chopping the air in your general direction. I will inevitably get around to the thing that pisses everybody off. At which point, I'm a piece of shit and fuck me for life. And they block me. I got blocked. You know how many times I've been blocked in the last couple of weeks? Here's the thing. I said, if I'm going to come back to social media, and the only reason I came back to social media at all...
Put dick pics in boxes. I got you.
...was under pressure to get out there and promote my art again. I originally came back just to get phone numbers from girls. Yeah, but the reason I went back again after that was because, you know, you gotta advertise in the newspaper or you're not going to get anywhere, right?
Right.
So I went back to social media today, the modern newspaper.
Stay out of the personal ads.
The thing is, that's who I am. That's what I do. When something pisses me off, I talk about it. I talk about it on this show. I talk about it on social media. I talk about it in essays on my website. I talk about it on the phone to my friends. I pray to Jesus at the end of the night about all the things I hate. I don't really do that, but you get what I'm saying. So I told myself, if I'm going to go back to that fucking cesspool, I'm not going to hold back this time. I'm always constantly on this precipice. I'm always about to throw myself off this metaphorical cliff. I say something because I truly believe it. And then my fans, the people who support me, the people who support this podcast, the people who support my writing, people who supported my films, get butthurt and come in the comments and write me novel-length, impassioned arguments against whatever thing I just said that pissed them off this time. Mm-hmm. It's fine when I do it when it pisses somebody else off.
Yeah.
But once I hit their nerve, they feel the need to write a fucking treatise About how big of a... Is that a word? Tristis?
It sounds like a word.
I'm going to look that up. About how big of a dickhead I am because I finally fucking said the thing that made them mad.
And then you make a comment back. I've seen some of these.
No.
You make a comment now.
I try not to make comments back.
No, I've watched this recent one. You make a comment back about, you know, you having your opinion and they having their opinion. And then all of a sudden... you know, you don't have to yell at me. And then they're like, well, I didn't yell at you. Well, yeah, look just right above my comment. Look just right above that comment is what I always want to say. Like, right there, you're fucking telling him he's the worst person in the world. But the second you point it out that, you know, you're just doing that, you'll get a comment and be like, oh, I'm not doing that.
It's a treatise, not a tristis.
Okay.
A treatise is a written work dealing formally and systematically with a subject. That was almost right. So, this time I decided if you're going to come into my... Okay, so here's how I look at my website. This is how I look at this podcast. This is how I look at my little corner of social media. It's my house. It might be a virtual house, and you might think it's way easier to talk shit on me in a virtual house than it is to come to my real house and have to do it to my face. But from now on, I'm going to treat every part of my little world here, Strangeville, exactly the same.
I have a problem with that. You're just, the audience can't tell. You just made a round earth with your hands.
Well, you know.
Now the flat earthers.
A flat plane.
A flat earther is going to be all over your ass.
A flat plane with a wall of ice around it, guarded by all governments.
Yeah, because you can't fly over Antarctica.
I've decided to keep it real, really real. I decided to keep it really, really real this time. And I'm going to treat every motherfucker that comes into my digital or my virtual house, wants to come to the party, wants to hang out and hear what I have to say, and then disrespect me standing in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to have a discussion... We can have a discussion. You and I have discussions all the time. I don't know everything. There's a lot of things I don't know.
Right.
And when we talk respectfully, I'm open to lots of new ideas. I don't shut out ideas. I don't shut out any ideas if we're having a conversation respectfully. If you're going to be at my party and I'm in the middle of discussing something, talking about something, being passionate about a belief I have, and you stand over there from the corner of the room and start disrespecting me, I'm going to smash you, and I'm going to eject you from my fucking house. And as I'm kicking you out the door, when you're going, freedom of speech, bro, I thought you were all about freedom of speech, I'm going to tell you that you have the right to say whatever you want as I'm beating your ass and kicking you out of my house because, number one, the most important thing is don't fucking be disrespectful. The second thing is say whatever you want. I'll entertain all ideas as long as motherfuckers stay respectful. The moment they disrespect me, I'm going to fucking smash them. I'm going to smash them virtually on the internet, and I'm going to smash them physically in fucking person. And I've had to tell a few people that over the last couple weeks on my social, quote-unquote, social media rampage. I had to tell a guy who said it was actually hit. So there was yet another big blow-up in the writing community, as there always is, endlessly. Another reason I quit social media. This one was this comes up every... at least 3 or 4 times a year. About every quarter, people argue about whether For the Love markets, where you submit your stories to anthologies and don't get paid for it, whether they're scams that are just going to make the editor of the anthology this rich fraud artist. We talked about that in previous episodes, right?
When I first started with you at Strange House, there was a guy that everybody was smashing on who just was incompetent. He wasn't like trying to steal anybody's
sometimes
money.
Sometimes it's incompetence. Sometimes it's people that just, they're trying to get started. They don't have any money. They're starting with authors that have no clout, no name, no track record for quality.
Well, there's one in specific we were talking about.
Christian Hansen. We talked about that. Yeah. I talked about him. I named him on my website when I was talking about the reasons that I eventually spoke out. One of the reasons was because the writing community gang raped that guy, mm-hmm. and kicked him out, and he's never come back. It's been 3 or 4 years, and the dude has never even attempted to step foot back in the literary community because of how poorly they treated him. And again, it's this idea that these guys are going to, it's like some kind of a, like they're getting rich off the shoulders of brand new authors that suck. Like, well, sucky ass.
That's what I always thought was funny about that. They were sitting there.
Nobody's making any money.
But he hadn't put anything out.
And in fact, Christian Hansen had given out fucking advances that he lost because those people just published their books and never gave him back his advances. That guy lost money and got gang raped out of the writing community. Mm-hmm. That's what drives me crazy about that guy. He lost money to get embarrassed. Publicly embarrassed.
He didn't just get embarrassed about his writing career, too. There was talk of pedophilia and all kinds of stuff, wasn't
there? That's from our favorite small press editor buddies that love to get into people's sex lives and try to come up with the most heinous...
Like, what?
The most heinous fucking issues. Unless it's their friends. If it's their friends, they're clearly innocent.
Yeah.
Clearly innocent until proven guilty. Technicalities be damned. Clearly.
But it was clearly just crazy. I was watching that whole thing go down, and it was just insane. They were talking about how he's a pedophile. You don't have any proof, but you're just going to call him a pedophile?
Because they don't like him. If they like you, then no amount of... In fact, I bet if they liked a person and they were proven guilty, it would just be the systematic oppression.
That's the social equivalence of running into a crowded theater and yelling fire.
So we're off on a long tangent because this was
gang bang mug.
This wasn't about that. This was about an author was we're still talking about gang bangs. We're talking about violent, rapey gang bangs against authors in the community. Anyway, so this should editors be able to publish work that they don't pay for? Should you only submit to markets that pay you? These are this argument comes up every 3 or 4 months. It's tired. It's been going on since long before I came around. And there was an author that was talking about how he hates it when authors gang up on each other and start these fights. Well, that is very relevant to my life. Mm-hmm. That's very relevant to the things I talk about. Fuck me. I went in there and dropped my comments on his social media post about it. His response was, "Quit trying to recruit me, kid."
What?
"Quit trying to recruit me, kid." So, I'm some kind of radical at this point to these people. Because these are all, you know, I haven't been on social media in months. I don't know how these people have received all these podcasts that we've done, all the essays that I've written railing against the ridiculous things that these people in the writing community do to each other. Well, apparently I'm perceived by at least this one guy as some kind of a radical that's now going around social... I'm only back on social media, apparently, to recruit people for my cause. Quit trying to recruit me, kid.
I'm just trying to come up with an acronym that's similar to ISIS, not Kevin Strange, because there's an S there. So,
So my response to him, even if I was at his house... So, this is his social media. So, I'm in his house. I've come to his party.
But were you respectful in your comments?
I was completely respectful in my comments. So this is him discussing, "Oh man, doesn't it suck when authors gang up on each other?" So I walk over and go, "I'd like to be a part of this discussion. Here's my thoughts on this. I have a lot of opinions on this. It's happened to me. It's happened to my friends. I've been watching it happen for years. Here's my opinions." And for this guy to look at me and say, "Quit trying to recruit me, kid," even in his own house. Like, if you don't want me there, if you don't want me in your house, you can respectfully ask me to leave. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've showed up at your party and you don't want me there because you don't like my reputation. You're going to respectfully ask me to leave if you want it to happen peacefully. If you disrespect me and say, "Get the fuck out of my house, douchebag," first thing I'm going to do is punch you in the fucking face because you've disrespected me. And as a man, I wouldn't have respect for myself if I let someone disrespect me, even if I'm in their home. So I responded to him, "Sure, okay. I apologize for trying to recruit you, but if you ever call me kid to my face, I'll smash you in your fucking mouth. Go fuck yourself." Mm-hmm. Oh, his tone immediately changed after that, didn't it? I don't know if you saw this thread or not, but he was like, "You know, I used to like you, man. I used to follow you on social media. But this rampage you've been on lately, I can't deal with it. and I'm not I'm not going to be a part of it. I'm paraphrasing. This was a few days ago, and I was like, "Cool, man, no problem. I'll get off your page and I'll leave you alone." But you know, as a man, I'm never going to let you disrespect me and call me names like kid. Just FYI, and I left, and that was it. And that was the end of it. But I had more people trying to do that on my own posts. I had a nice, I thought very well written kind of a rant about I forget what it even which thread was that? Was it about nepotism in the writing community?
I don't remember.
I've got it here. If you give me just a second, I can look it up. Or you, if
rants,
you try to
go, I'm on your page now. Rants of Kevin Strange. Social justice is cringy, preachy, and lame. Alex Jones, Tower 7, the media today.
Did you see that? Did you see he did a press conference after his, because he, there was a gag order on his child custody case until Friday. So Friday he did a press conference in front of the courthouse, and he fucking bossed those motherfuckers.
I mean,
he absolutely.
Then your Craig Spector thing.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that at the end of the show. I've got a bunch of news, a bunch of good news to talk about, but we are really off in the weeds here.
Oh yeah,
talking about this.
Roseanne.
I'm going through.
Will Scar.
This stuff. No, this was days ago, man. You're not gonna find it if you just give me a second here.
Give me a day, and I could probably find it. I don't know. Maybe you are on a rampage.
I am. I absolutely am. Suffice it to say,
Baked Alaska, Antifa.
Is it trendy? Is that this thing?
I mean, we're doing a lot of dead air right now. Looking at
no,
your Facebook
it doesn't
page.
Matter. It's not as long as you think it is. It's just a couple of days. Okay, yeah. Trendy is the new merit. Is what I called this. I'm gonna. Is it okay if I read it on the
air?
That's right. If, as an author, you act like a sycophantic little cuck and kiss all the right asses, join all the right groups, and say all the right PC things to get nominated for literary awards, I'll give you your props. I'll send a little golf clap your way. I'll concede that it's mildly difficult to socially climb into a position of preferential treatment. It takes at least a set of social skills equivalent to those of a kindergartner at recess to navigate the literary community's grade school-like popularity contests. Admittedly, some authors don't even possess those limited skills, and you'll always be able to show off your nominations or awards like the newest pair of trendy jeans or tennis shoes. But you'll know, and your popular friends will know, that deep down in your hearts, the place where it truly counts, that you didn't actually earn those awards on the merit of your art. You probably already know you're not a good writer, which is why you spend so much time and effort socially climbing. And that's fine. You'll justify that you put in a lot of work to be trendy and popular. Right?
Right.
It is. It's a lot of work to be trendy and popular and hang out on social media 24/7, 7 days a week, making sure you kiss all the right asses, don't piss off the people you're not supposed to piss off. It's exhausting work, but it's not artistic work. Not artistic work in the least.
So I go on, times, work on your craft.
I go on to say, but what if, and try to follow me here, what if as an artist, as an author, and as a creator of prose, you actually took pride in your work? What if the stories you produced came from the fire, the pain, the deepest, most difficult places to unlock in your psyche? What if your art moved your readers to tears? What if it inspired them to bare their soul and bleed on the page alongside you? What if you wrote from your mind and your hand? What if what you wrote from your mind and your hand stood the test of time and changed the path of literature forever? And what
don't
if
cry.
Those
It'll
what if
right.
those razor sharp stories infused with nuclear energy for generations to come sandblasted the shallow, vapid, trendy competition into oblivion and earned themselves nominations and awards, not because of your social status, but in spite of how unpopular or politically incorrect your opinions or social ranking may be? How good do you think that would feel? Well, that would actually take patience, practice, talent, and skill, wouldn't it? Nobody has time for that. You've got 22 Facebook notifications and a new meme to share. So that was my Facebook post. And I actually saved that as a little mini essay for my upcoming book of rants that will be coming out in the next few months. That was my post, okay?
Uh-huh.
I thought it was well written, articulate, and whether you whether you are a writer of merit or you are a trendy poser, you can't deny the truth to that statement. That it would feel much better for your art to be nominated and win awards because of how good it is, as opposed to how much the judges like you as a person.
Oh, you would be as a real person, a real alpha
male. I think anybody would, but a lot of people know they're not good.
I don't know.
There's a lot of people know they're not good artists, so they have to overcompensate.
I think with the social that they with their a lot of personality types would feel better just winning rather than actually achieving it.
You think it would make them feel better to know that they gamed the system?
Them, not us.
I'm saying I don't think that they would go. They don't want to go into things wanting to cheat. They cheat, and people are going to take issue with whether or not this is cheating or not. I'm saying cheating your own artistic value. I'm not saying cheating as in the awards are fixed. I'm saying cheating your own artistic ability. I don't think people go into this type of thing wanting to cheat. They eventually do because they realize they're not good at it. And the only way they're going to achieve anything if they cheat themselves.
From our perspective, but there's some people like that never grew up from that kid when you're out at the store that wants the toy.
Yeah.
You don't care that he embarrasses his mother by throwing a fit, wallowing on the ground over the toy.
No, he doesn't care.
He just wants the end result of the toy. So.
But I guess I look at a kid like that and I think at some point he gave up. Even that little kid. At some point he stopped trying to get things based on logic and reason and started trying to get them through emotional appeal. But maybe he never did. Right. Maybe he never did.
Logic and reason usually comes after emotional appeal with children. It's part of growing up. Now we've grown
up.
Okay,
so you're saying that it starts with that and it eventually moves on. You eventually mature to a point where you realize that your skills and abilities can stand on their own.
Oh, yeah.
It's an evolution to that, not away from it.
Yeah, okay. Right. That kind of becomes natural, the little fits. Because you haven't had a child yet. Once your child gets a little older and realizes they can win without doing that fit, without embarrassing you quicker than that fight, through logic and stuff. I mean, my daughter's won a million arguments with me just by coming straightforward logically at me. And
right.
Then you got to be the irrational one as a parent, and then that doesn't.
Because I fucking said so.
Exactly,
and you lose at that point,
and you've lost whether you've done it or not. You're just now the bad guy.
So, why do I bring up this post? Why did I read it? Because a couple people came at me in the comments. They read that. They read that. And then came at me in the comments like, I'm really sick of your bullshit. I'm sick of you trying to be this rebellious author. This is, you know, it's just a bunch of bullshit.
Is it rebellious as an author to try to want to work on your own work?
It made me so fucking mad. This guy was like, this outlaw author shtick is getting old. I was like, who the fuck are you to walk into my shit when I make a point that valid? Who are you to walk into my shit and talk shit on me?
How is personally? The art now, to focus on your art is basically...
Is being considered an outlaw.
Is being
That's
an outlaw.
That's why I quit social media, Jeremy Daniels. That's why I can't stand this crowd. And we're going to get to... This is going to be a long episode. We're going to get to... we're going to get to that. Let's get to it right now because we're over time.
All
right. We need to discuss a couple more things. I don't know how to do this. We've got new. I wanted to spend after the reading, the part three of Cotton Candy. I wanted to spend talking about these cool ass new things that are coming, and I still have things that are really pertinent that I want to discuss. But we're already out of time.
Well, maybe we could rapid fire them real quick.
They deserve the whole. I mean, I wanted to do this the whole episode. Okay, let's go ahead and skip the one. We're not gonna cover. We'll cover that one some other time. So completely relevant to all of this. Okay, mm-hmm. It's the Stoker Awards are this.
We're skipping the 7. That's the one we're skipping.
No.
Okay,
that's the one we're because that the other one is a different award for a different thing. The audience doesn't know what we're talking about. It's okay. We'll come back to it. We'll talk about it next week. So there's an award ceremony going on this weekend. A lot of nominations have been announced, and for whatever reason, that always gets these people riled up. To close that segment that we were just on, the point is, I'm always going to piss you off. At some point, I'm going to get to the thing you like, and you're going to get mad at me. And my plea to my audience, to the people who listen to this show, to the people who follow me on social media, that read my books, that come and hang out at shows, don't take it so fucking personally.
Yeah.
When I say liberals are fucking sensitive retards, and you say, but I'm a liberal, understand that I'm not talking about you personally. You are giving yourself that label and then getting upset with me about it. That label is toxic. And here are the reasons that I say that label is toxic. And for you to come into my social media comments or call me on the phone or come up to me in person and say, like, I consider myself that thing you don't like. That's not my problem. I didn't say I didn't like you personally. Jeremy Daniels, how few times do I actually attack people personally?
Not very often.
It's always ideas. I attack ideas. I attack ideologies and labels.
But when you wrap those ideas around your body, you'll take it personally.
But it's not my responsibility when other people are wrapping those ideologies around their own bodies. I consider myself... I don't care. I wasn't talking about you personally. So please, this is an impassioned plea to the audience. Don't take what I say personally. If I criticize the things you love, maybe consider that the things you love might suck. And that's not a slight to you as a person.
I mean, we're both ICP fans. A lot of people say they suck.
A lot of people hate Juggalos. I don't give a fuck. I don't get into threads and arguments and try to defend Juggalos. I don't care. It's not an ideology I wrap myself in and die. I don't die on the hill of Juggaloism because I know a lot of Juggalos fucking suck. And the way mainstream looks at Juggalos, the extreme cases they take from Juggalos, those cases suck. Those guys that end up on the news, they suck. There's no defending those people. Fuck them. They're fucking retarded. And they carry the name Juggalo. Well, is that how you act? No. That's all I have to say. I'm not wrapping myself in it and dying on the hill. I consider myself a Juggalo, and that's not the way I act. No. If you're going to ask me, so do you act, are you retarded? No. I always thought
that was the point of being a Juggalo, too.
No. I mean. Yeah, to be retarded.
Well, but to be retarded and not to wrap it yourself around it, the song, What is a Juggalo?
There's no definition.
I never put a 2-liter in my butt.
There's no definition of it. It's just being weird and retarded. Anyway, to wrap up this whole segment, and we're going to go to this glorious third part of Cotton Candy.
The sexy part.
We get to the gangbang finally in Gangbang Month. It's been a while. Mm-hmm. No, it hasn't. We did a segment. I keep forgetting. We jumped in the middle of this motherfucker and put a gay Jesus episode in, and it fucked me all up. So we still have 2 episodes left of Cotton Candy.
Yes.
2 episodes. Mm-hmm. Today being one of those. But first, I have to address this. And this goes right along with, if the person who wrote this article is listening, if the person who wrote this article's friends are listening, I am not attacking her as an individual. I am attacking her ideas. If she wants to wrap herself in these ideas and die on the hill for them, that's her problem, not mine. I have no personal problem with this girl. Do I have to preface this anymore, Jeremy? Is there any other way I can say this to make it more clear that I am attacking a set of ideas?
We could go on for 2 hours and then still say that you're attacking this girl rather than that.
I don't know this girl. I have nothing against her. If I met her on the street, I probably wouldn't even talk to her because I hate everybody. And I assume that everybody's retarded and I don't want to be their friend. People, I don't understand why they don't get this through their heads. I have very few friends, don't I? All right, we're going to talk about the unbuddy system, okay? Because this comes up over and over and over again. It's coming up because of this fight about free anthologies. It's coming up because the Stoker Awards are this weekend. These people will never let this go, and they will constantly defend themselves because they so egregiously are this thing. Mm. And that thing is they are a sycophantic, nepotistic group of social climbers who look for any advantage they can to look popular among their part-time writer friends. Mm-hmm. Part-time writer, full-time Facebook activist is what these people are. I told you before on one of these podcasts, when we were talking about the Bizarro community and Bizarro Gate and the different editors, that I have a big problem with the way they treat other writers. And I talked about an incident that happened years ago. And this is how petty these people are. They keep this thing going year after year after year because they are just petty and have nothing better to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. There was an author. He got mad because anything he submitted to these small press horror publishers would either get rejected or ignored. He would never be looked at by the merit of his work because he wasn't friends. He didn't make friends with any of these people. He didn't hang out with them online. He's an older guy. He doesn't understand social media the way they do. He doesn't play Facebook popularity contest 24/7. And he got mad and accused these people of being nepotistic. And the way he described it was that they have a little buddy system where they all publish each other and they all talk sycophantically about each other. It's all disingenuous. These people, for the most part, are average writers at best, and they all talk about each other like they're the second coming of fucking whoever. And this guy pointed it out, and he called them a buddy system. And they have never let it go. They've never stopped facetiously making fun of this guy. And this girl decided to post. This is brand new. Even though the buddy system argument started in like 2014 or 15, it's the middle of 2017, and this girl had to write an article called The Unbuddy System to prove that they're not nepotistic, to prove that they're not a bunch of little sycophants that only publish each other, that aren't concerned about merit as much as they're concerned with popularity. Okay?
No.
It's very telling that this girl lists
six. I hate when people say seven and they actually only have six. They repeat themselves on one of them.
So blah 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 blah. The truth. I'm quoting her article here. Mm-hmm. Blah 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 blah. The truth of the matter is that the buddy system does exist, but it's hardly a clandestine sect of robed and masked authors who control the industry. The buddy system is this: my list of simple rules for success. Here they are in no particular order. Before we get into these.
Well, if we're going to go with
before we get into these,
success, none of them are really going to be success.
The fact that she sees these forthcoming seven rules as rules for success, and none of them, not one of them, has anything to do with writing. To be a successful writer, do these seven things. None of them are be a good writer. None of them are practice your craft. None of them are read the greats, read the geniuses, learn the tricks of the trade. And by tricks, I don't mean the tricks of popularity. I mean the tricks of how to write convincingly and make your reader feel something that they'll never forget.
Well,
none of those things are on this list.
In the first one, go ahead and say what the first one is.
Don't be an ass.
All right. In the first one, she says, so go off and then rant and rave and end up alienating people who didn't even know that, or you didn't even know were reading your post. Writers do, I mean, even the best. We can, George Martin, right? Game of Thrones, considered a good writer, right? He alienates people all the time. He'll take your fucking favorite character, cut his fucking head off, and fucking stick it on a post in one of the books. In his actual work. I mean, if anybody else was doing that, he's being an ass to his own readers because he's making you fall in love with a character and then killing him off just for his own enjoyment. And she's like, no, I don't know, you could alienate him. I mean, a good writer is going to alienate you. I am sure that...
So, listen. Number one, don't be an ass. Someone says something you disagree with, you go off on them and rant and rave and end up alienating people you didn't even know reading your posts. Not good. Okay, so this is what I do all day long. right? Mm-hmm. We've spent the last 40 minutes talking about how much I alienate people and piss them off. Why? Why did I say I did that? Because I'm being honest. Honest with myself and honest with my audience. So the very first thing she says, the rules of success, Jeremy. Number one is be dishonest.
Yep, pretty much.
Number one is be dishonest.
Or be quiet about it.
I consider that being dishonest to yourself.
Oh, yeah. I'm done.
This idea of like, well, let's just keep things civil. Let's keep things civil. Let's keep your mouth shut about controversial topics. Don't be controversial. That is doing a disservice to yourself. You are not being honest to your fans, and you're not being honest in your fiction. Because even though she talks about writing zero times in this list, the fact of the matter is, writers like her will not write honestly in their fiction. They will not write honestly in their fiction. They will pander to social norms, and in 50 years, their writings will be completely forgotten because they were not, mm-hmm. they didn't counter any or challenge any social, pervasively social ideas at the time.
And uses one of the most fucked up examples. Rabid tire fires teeming with the textual equivalent of flaming armadillos wrapped in razor wire are quite another.
That's what I don't know what
fuck
that means.
Does that even
it
mean?
It means she's a bad writer. Number two, be a good citizen of the genre. Conduct yourself in a manner befitting to the image you're trying to get. And again, it's all about image. Mm-hmm. To be a successful writer, it's all about presenting an image. It's all about being a used car salesman. It's all about how you part your hair, the clothes you wear, how straight your teeth are. It's all about wearing trendy hats. It's all about wearing trendy jackets. Especially, it's all about using trendy lingo. It drives me crazy, Jeremy.
Especially at related events like conventions, book signings, or release parties. We create a manner that fits our image because it's us at the conventions. It's me and you.
It's a truth and honesty. Yes, it's a truth and honesty. And again, if you show up, just be a good citizen of the genre. Conduct yourself in a manner benefiting the image you're trying to convey. Okay, I get the image you're trying to convey. The image I'm trying to convey is an image of honesty. Honesty to myself and to my audience. Mm-hmm. The fact that these people want to wear the trendiest jackets, the trendiest hats, spit the trendiest lingo, follow the trendiest ideologies of the time, means that in 50 years, they will be 100% forgotten. You don't remember the trendy people of a generation. You remember the rabble-rousers. You remember the people that fought against the grain. You remember the people, the best artists, the ones that are remembered throughout time, generation after generation, are the ones that pushed against social norms and challenged ideologies, not the ones that created an image beneficial to your blah, blah, blah. It enrages me. This stuff enrages me if you can't tell. Number three, know your limits. If you can't handle more than a few shots of bourbon.
Worst advice for a writer ever.
So number three is the rape culture shit. We talked about this on episode three, how to survive conventions for white guys. This is feminist pandering. It's all on the dude to not look at me. Don't look at me. Don't talk to me. Don't say things that I'll you know, you'll be accused of sexual harassment, sexual assault. All these. This is the epicenter of that. The stuff that we talk about on this show about being fucking about. Don't even make eye contact with these women. Don't go anywhere near them. Don't fucking even socialize with them, because if they don't like you, they will weaponize every word you say. Mm-hmm. They will weaponize every action you take. They will weaponize everything they can about you to systematically destroy your career. And there are a bunch of people in this community that will jump on the bandwagon regardless of the proof, regardless of charges filed. There are never charges filed, first of all. So this number three, know your limits. This is everything about this pisses me off, because this is everything that goes into, we will accuse you of sexual assault, but we will never file charges. We will just excommunicate you from our...
Here's what makes me mad. The example she uses of false equivalency. I mean,
right.
Plain and simple.
Right.
Drinking, right. When it comes to knowing your limits, is one thing. That's being a normal person. You know, you want to... You know, all that stuff fits in being a normal, upstanding person when it comes to drinking. When it comes to your craft, you need to push your craft every fucking day. Athletes, they push their craft every day to become better athletes. Writers should push their craft to the limit to become better writers. You never never hear of anybody saying, well, he kept it at his limit. That's why he's successful. It's fucking horrible advice.
She's literally talking about drinking. She's literally talking about drunk men will rape women, so don't get drunk. That's what this
is. But this is all supposed to be about writing.
It's not about writing. None of it is about writing. In fact, number four here is the closest thing that we have to advice about actual writing. Be easy to work with, blah, blah, blah. Don't fuck with your potential publishers or fellow authors or, you know, whatever. Again, it's this thing where fuck honesty. What you need to do is don't rock the boat. Make sure that everything you do is you're always thinking about the social implications of everything you do.
And that's all she means with be easy to work with is the social implications. She's not talking about get your shit done when you say
she's talking about the quote unquote bad reputation you'll get if you're hard to work with an editor. In other words, these people are terrified that if they stand up for their own artistic integrity and tell an editor, I don't agree with those changes, it changes the merit of my work. And if you do that too many times to too many publishers, that they will get behind the scenes and talk to each other and blacklist you from the writing community, from being published in their anthologies and collections and having your novels published to them because you're too difficult. And the idea here, the idea that she's trying to present as being difficult to work with is standing up for your own artistic integrity. Again, all of these rules are just completely throw artistic integrity out of the fucking water.
Yeah.
Artistic integrity is the only thing that matters. The only reason we're writing this stuff is because it will live on for generations after we're dead. This is our mark that we're leaving on the universe. Artists create. It's literally creation. We are creating. When you put something new into the world that didn't exist there before, if you do so without integrity, it is meaningless. It is meaningless, and it will be soon forgotten. And if you write, and if the only reason you're writing is, to be in a small group of people, is the trendiness of it, is the popularity contest, fuck you, fuck everything you stand for, and you're going to be forgotten. And you don't care, because when you're dead, you're not worried about what happens to your work after you're dead. You're worried about being invited to that party. You're worried about being considered cool among this small group of people, and that pisses me off. It enrages me. Yeah. It enrages me more than anything. And people often accuse me of only having this attitude because I'm somehow a failure. I've achieved all the same fucking things these people have achieved. I've been in the anthologies. I've gotten the awards. I've gotten the nominations. I've been to the fucking gatherings. I've schmoozed. I've been here and there. I've gone and done readings. I've traveled all across the country and done all this. My attitude has nothing to do with my level of artistic success. My level of artistic success is, I can challenge almost any one of those people to show me a better resume than what I have. It has nothing to do
with... I'd challenge any of them to be at a convention we're at and sell more books.
And sell more books than us, right? My attitude has nothing... You look at a...
There's only two or three I can think of.
You look at a writer like Harlan Ellison, who is one of the biggest assholes in science fiction, if not the biggest asshole in science fiction. He fucking hates people, and if you try to talk to him, he fucking belittles you. He belittles you. If you go up to him at a convention and start talking to him and he doesn't like what you're saying, he will give you a verbal fucking lashing and send you on your way and tell you to go fuck yourself and never talk to him again. Guess what? He's got more Hugo awards. It's either Hugo or Nebula. He's got more in for one particular award, he has the record. He holds the record for that number of that award, whether it be the Nebula or the Hugo. I think it's the Nebula, actually. People can't accuse him of being angry because he's not successful, right? So the first thing they do is try to accuse you of being angry because you're not successful. God forbid it's because you have a passion for what you do. It's because you see other people that have no passion and they're only doing so to be social climbers. That's okay. It's okay that makes me mad. It makes sense that makes me mad.
It's the same group that as soon as you started stirring the pot, they started talking about, oh, he's not selling any books. And you're like, you don't have any of those numbers, A. B, yeah, you're... But nobody's getting rich off this, because, nobody in our job...
Everybody, look, you want to talk about numbers. Everybody put their numbers out there. See how embarrassed these people are to sell double digits of their fucking book. But they're super trendy and popular in the community. They won't put their numbers out there.
Yeah.
They'll fucking sell 10 copies of their new book, but they'll never put it out there because they're fucking, friends with Susie and Johnny, and they've fucking been nominated for Susie and Johnny's award. Number five, be a good citizen of our community. Look, our community. She identifies the community as hers. Not your community. Don't be a good citizen of your community. Be a good citizen of our community. She identifies as the community. if you read something, review it on Amazon. Oh, this is the fucking worst. This is the fucking worst. Be a good citizen of the community. Be a good citizen means disingenuously give 5-star reviews to all of your friends on Amazon. That is, it happens all the time. People don't even pay attention. Authors know better when they're going to buy books from their contemporaries, from people that are publishing right now. They fucking know better than to pay attention to any of those 5-star reviews. Because those books will have 250 5-star reviews, and they're all from their fucking trendy buddies. They're all disingenuous. What you need to do, this is a lesson, this is a pro tip from Kevin Strange here to the audience, to anybody that buys books on Amazon, look for the 3-star reviews. The 3-star reviews are the honest reviews.
See, I like the 1-star
reviews. The 1-star reviews are usually from rivals, from people that don't like you.
But
the 3-star reviews...
I loved our, when we were working together, I loved our 1-star reviews because most of them were like, well, it's not my thing.
Right.
Or, you know, there was...
I find the 3-star reviews to be the most honest. Those are from readers that don't know you. They have nothing to gain. The fact of the matter is, these other authors, they're giving you 5-star reviews, so you'll give their books 5-star reviews. They have everything to gain in their minds by praising your book. These are all disingenuous. These are all sycophantic reviews. So her number 5 here is ridiculous. Mm. And it's one of the things that pisses me off the most about these people. You can go, I've told people to do this before. Go to goodreads.com/KevinStrange. And look at all my books that were published under Strange House when I was an editor, when I was the owner of a publishing house, when people had everything to gain by possibly getting published by me. Look at how many 5-star reviews my books got compared to when I left the business and started publishing myself, and I stopped editing, and none of these authors had any incentive to kiss my ass anymore. Look at the drastic decrease in 5-star reviews. Did I become a crappy writer overnight? No, I stopped being a publisher overnight. And that is the power of, that's the power that publisher slash writers hold over other writers.
Yeah.
They think if I give them a bunch of 5-star reviews, they'll publish my new book. Mm-hmm. It is all sycophantic, gross nonsense. Number 6, network. Make friends without the goal of climbing some imaginary ladder. So that is her projecting the fact that she she just right out of the gate knows that she's networking to climb a ladder. That's trying to deflect and project.
Networking is such a buzzword. You network. I mean, we network in the industry I work for a real job in. And it's not about trying to climb a ladder. It's not trying all this reach out, create a network, blah, blah, blah. It's none of that. It's all about having people in that you know dealing with the same problems with the work and that can relate to you with the work and have ideas to help you with your work. This is get a lot of friends. That's basically what it means. Just get a lot of friends
because that's all this is about. This is all about being trendy, putting on the social hat of writer, the social identity. This is all about identity, the identity of being, I am a quote-unquote writer. That's why I call them full-time Facebook writers.
Yeah.
This girl is a full-time Facebook writer. She's on Facebook 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, between Facebook and Twitter. You will never see these people absent. And if they are absent, it's for some crazy, dramatic reason. And when they come back, I'm so sorry I haven't been here, guys. Mm. And it's this, you know what I mean? It's.
I mean, networking is good. Use networking the way it's supposed to be.
All right. We're
at like an hour.
We're completely over time. So
number 7's be an ass. Don't be an ass again. So
yeah, don't be an ass again. So her 7 points here have been covered. I think I've debunked each of them as thoroughly.
Yeah.
We've handled this as thoroughly as we could. Gone completely over time.
Like, yeah, like 20 minutes ago we told them some sweet gangbang goodness.
So are we not going to come back afterwards? We're just going to
do the reading? Back for a little bit, but we're just going to talk about... We're not going to talk about any more of this stuff. We're going to talk about interesting Kevin Strange stuff. And where
we'll
we're
go another around. Hour if I start talking about
all that stuff. So if you do want to stick around, it's just going to be like news and updates and stuff like that.
All right.
This
is Cotton Candy, Part 3. Gang. We'll see you on the other side if you stick around.
If you stick around, I mean, most of you probably tuned out already.
What's up, you reader fucks? My name's Kevin Strange.
And this is Travis.
And we're here from the Watching with Strangers podcast, because there's other things in the world besides books, too, you bookish fucks. We review cult movies. What kind of cult movies do we review, Travis?
All kinds of cult movies.
Like what?
Cultists of the cult, including Cult from the Future.
Cult movies from the future at kevinthestrange.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever other podcasts fuck, you fucks. We followed her up two sets of spiral stairs. The old house was massive, truly huge. We walked down a long corridor, all of us watching Estella's taut little ass sway back and forth. The only sound was that of Fat Bob's panicked wheezing trailing 20 feet to the rear of our entourage. Estella stopped at the end of the expansive hallway, spun around, and put her hands on her hips. She looked each of us full in the eyes and grinned. That look of intelligence beyond her years gripped me. I wanted her badly. My pulse began to race with lustful intention, and I had yet to lay a single hand on her.
"I hope you all like to play dress-up," she said,
that grin turning mischievous again. Fat Bob trotted up behind us, folding chair in hand, clanking against the walls as he waddled. "What are we dressing up as, love?" Maxwell asked. "Pirates? Robin Hood's merry men?" one of the Cum brothers added. "Ninjas!" Big D yelled, clearly stoned off his tiny ass. In response, the door behind Estella swung open. The smell hit me first, but the others soon remarked about it as well. It appeared the source of the mysterious cotton candy smell had been located, and it was, in fact, coming directly from the room in front of us. It would have been a sweet smell, and not entirely unpleasant, had it not been so pungent. Estella walked inside without answering, gesturing for us to follow with a single, sultry wave. The answer, it turned out, was obvious upon entering the room.
"What the fuck kind of bullshit is this?"
Big D said, surveying the room's bizarre contents. The first item that drew the group's attention in what must have been the huge house's master bedroom was an enormous lump of shaggy purple fur, roughly the size of a medium-sized dog, that sat directly in the middle of the room. But what made the thing so weird, and what caused Big D to cry out and cringe when he saw it, was that the lump had enormous eyes, large, pointy ears, and a wide mouth set with many sharp fangs. Upon closer inspection, though, it became clear that the eyes were plastic and the mouth was sewn on. It was a stuffed animal. A bright, day-glow purple, plushy beanbag chair. The rest of the room looked much like the rest of the house, cluttered and very lived in, which matched neither the age nor the demeanor of either the party planner or Estella. What drew our attention next was a totally weird collection of normal-sized plushy animals strapped to the headboard of a king-sized bed up against the far wall. There were scores of them. Big plushy bears, little plushy cats, there were birds and mice, dogs and lizards, dozens and dozens of stuffed toys, all different shapes, sizes, and colors, all corded, one on top of the other against the headboard. On the far side of the room stood Estella and the party planner. They stood next to a long wardrobe rack.
"You will each choose a costume. You must wear the costume for the duration of the evening. Under no circumstances are you to remove the costume. Removal of the costume will result in ejection from the party. Do you understand?"
The seven of us stood speechless. The costumes in question were all human-sized plushy animal outfits with oversized heads containing enormous plastic eyes and freakishly wide smiles. Wide enough, I realized, to accommodate a person's face. The arm sleeves on each outfit ended in paw-like gloves with three clawed fingers on each paw. The garments continued down into legs with enormous clawed booties. Each furry, neon-colored costume lacked a crotch.
"Furry party!"
Vern said, finally breaking the stunned silence.
"Wicked cool!"
While I'd never heard of it before, I did not need any explanation of what the term furry meant. My anticipation, while certainly diminished at the thought of dressing up like a giant toy animal, had not been entirely extinguished. I would still, after all, be participating in my first gangbang, and that, in and of itself, kept me barreling forward towards my strange and unfortunate destiny. The Cum brothers were first up to the rack. They rifled through the costumes, laughing and joking at the ridiculous get-ups.
They settled on shaggy, canary-yellow puppy outfits. The heads had long, drooping ears and big, oval-shaped eyes suggesting cute sadness. They even had red tongues that hung lazily off the sides of their faces. The brothers then scampered up onto the bed, barking at each other and playfully sniffing each other's rear ends. Maxwell stepped forward next.
"How utterly bizarre,"
he said, as he methodically picked through the costumes. He chose a fire-red, majestic lion costume. The head was huge, larger than any of the other outfits, and the felt teeth surrounding Maxwell's face made him look like some ancient tribal shaman. The huge, shaggy mane hanging across his shoulders and chest was a bright pink, and his paws and booties were oversized as well, with long pink talons. The whole outfit ended in a skinny tail with a fuzzy pink ball at the end. Maxwell mock-roared and beat his chest as he took his place with the Cum Brothers. Vern and I were next.
A fucking furry party. This is so awesome. The last time I did one of these, we all took turns running a train on a zebra in full costume. We didn't even know what the bitch looked like till we all busted nuts up her ass. And guess what? It turned out she was the hottest chick at the party.
He laughed.
I love this weird shit, man.
I picked through the costumes. Do I really have to wear one of these?
Don't be a drag, Mr. P. Here, this will fit you perfectly.
He handed me a purple teddy bear head with bulging eyes and a huge smile that suggested it had just told the funniest joke ever and was waiting for a reaction. Reluctantly, I disrobed and put it on. Vern was right. The whole ridiculous suit fits snug. I was now a giant teddy bear with a human face sticking out of its mouth and a human cock swinging between its legs. Utterly ridiculous. I could not help but remember my Second Life morals. No children and no animals. While no one here was innocent, the irony was not lost on me that I was about to fornicate with a woman young enough to be my granddaughter while dressed as an animal. Vern donned a shaggy brown elephant costume featuring an obnoxious trunk jutting directly out of his forehead area, and we joined the others near the bed. Big D soon came over, balancing the much too large head of an orange hippo atop his own cranium.
"You know, that's a lady hippo, D,"
one of the Cum Brothers said, pointing at the gaudy blush across the hippo's fat cheeks and red lipstick across its mouth.
"This was the smallest motherfucker they had, man, damn!"
He put on the suit, which comically hung from his arms. He trailed a good 2.5 feet of legging behind him.
"Bullshit, man! These motherfuckers prejudice against little people!"
"Fat people, too,"
Bob said, slamming his chair down with an angry thunk. He wore a tall blue eagle head over his own like a tiara. The head barely fit over his bulbous skull like a hat, coming in no way close to covering his face. The costume, obviously, lay discarded at his feet. Our motley crew of degenerate stuffed animal people stood around this way, idly chatting for several minutes. That is, until Miss Estella stepped out from behind the wardrobe. Our chatter fell away as we took in the heavenly sight before us. She had added to her already provocative outfit a series of modifications that struck from my mind the horrific possibility that we would be taking turns butt-fucking a toy zebra. She wore a hot pink teddy bear head over her own, the mouth set in a wide yawn, revealing her magnificent face within. She wore paw gloves up to the wrist, a fuzzy pink belt around her micro-skirt that ended in a long, thin tail, and shaggy pink leggings that started at the knee and extended down until they attached to a pair of 6-inch heel boots, which terminated in paw tips with bright purple claws. The party creep dragged that weird beanbag chair to the middle of the floor. Now that I'd seen her outfit, I realized that the dreadful thing looked just like the bear head Estella wore. The most unsettling part about it was that grin of sharp teeth, as though it were in on some joke or privy to some information that the rest of us were not. We all stared at it with apprehension until Stella sat on top of it and said,
"I want 3 dicks in my mouth and 1 in each hand right now."
That was enough to break the trance. The Cum Brothers pushed past the rest of us, complying with Estella's request. Big D ran up and jumped on her knee, adding a 3rd cock to her mouth. Maxwell stood off to the left, offering his cadaver dick to her welcoming fist. As she began to stroke him, Maxwell flipped a switch on the belt strap, causing the jelly dildo to vibrate inside his vagina. He moaned softly as Estella's strokes pushed and pulled the fake cock inside of him. Vern punched me softly in the ribs.
"See you on the other side, buddy."
He took Estella's right side, leaving only Fat Bob and I to fondle our dicks in anticipation. Estella rhythmically stroked and sucked back and forth between the three cocks in front of her for several minutes, gasping and begging for dick the entire time, working herself up to bigger and better things to come.
"Fat man," she said after a while, "lick my ass. Old dude, come here and get your dick sucked."
Bob abandoned his chair and moved behind the more sinister one occupied by our lovely hostess. He squatted down as much as his girth would allow, made a move to unbuckle her tail belt and skirt.
"No,"
she said, her annoyance clear, even though she spoke with Big D's enormous limp dick halfway down her throat.
"Leave it on."
Bob complied, lifting instead the furry garments up and out of the way as he feasted on her young asshole with the same vigor and enthusiasm he might have used to attack a gourmet dinner. This made Estella moan even louder. She slowly unleashed Big D's Big D from her mouth. He dropped down to his back and began to lick her pussy as I stepped up to take his spot. She looked at my hard cock.
"Not bad for an old white man."
She grinned and took the whole thing in her mouth with a slight gagging sound. She stuck out her tongue when she reached the base, licking my balls as she smashed her face against my stomach. I gasped. Vern chuckled and lifted his hand for a high five. He smiled wide and mouthed the words, "Holy shit." I obliged, slapping his hand. This was everything I'd hoped it would be, in spite of the silly costumes and decor. She extracted my cock from her gullet and returned to work on the Cum Brothers. I noticed that one of the muscle-bound men had a dick that pointed nearly straight up to his navel. While his brother's rod yielded nearly exactly the same length and girth, it suffered from a severe downward curve. This allowed them to cross their members near the tips and seesaw them into Estella's welcome mouth at the same time. We continued in this way for several minutes, eventually changing positions in such a way that each of us received our share of oral pleasure, anal and cunnilingus, and manual stimulation until the room was noticeably warmer, with the smell of sweat and pussy beginning to overpower the odd cotton candy odor. The sound of our ecstasy bounced off the walls, reverberating back to us, fueling our lust. We were, each of us, lost in our private nirvana of flesh. If our cocks truly had faces, in that moment, they would have been smiling. Then the weird little creeper broke the spell. I didn't even realize he was still in the room until he spoke.
"Let's move this to the bed, Essie."
Our lover's high interrupted. We all looked over at him standing there, tapping his watch impatiently. He'd been watching us the whole time. Creepy. Estella humped with annoyance as she leapt up and made her way to the bed. She climbed up onto her hands and knees at the base of that ominous headboard full of little miniature versions of us, staring down in anticipation of the evening's sexual climax. She stuck her ass high in the air, turned to us and said,
"I want a cock in all of my holes."
I loved her commands. She was my general in the army of fucking her silly. The fuzzy men around me were my brothers in arms. Our artillery, our exposed cocks. No shame, no dignity, our only mission? Fuck our leader senseless. I was first to the bed. I mounted her from behind, cock throbbing from all the foreplay. I was ready to fulfill my biggest sexual fantasy. Vern scooted underneath our hostess, lying on his back. Together, we entered her velvety folds. I moved her pink tail aside and penetrated her anus with relative ease. The oral stimulation had loosened her asshole enough for me to get my swollen dickhead inside with very little effort. Estella sucked in a harsh breath as I worked my thickness slowly deeper into her tush. I felt Vernon's cock push into her pussy, the pressure tightening her bunghole around my shaft. As we worked up and down, Estella cried out. I could feel the many rings attached to his wang through the membrane separating her vaginal canal from her anal cavity. It felt marvelous. I was forced to use all of my concentration to keep from blowing my load right then. I took a deep breath and slowed my thrusting. I wanted to savor this moment, needed to savor it. The beast had been craving this for so long. I couldn't spoil it now by busting a nut early like a chump.
"Pull my hair, you geriatric fuck,"
she commanded.
"Stick a cock in my mouth now."
As I yanked on the long blonde locks from beneath her bare head, Maxwell climbed up on the bed, cramming his dead dick down her throat, gag-fucking her until saliva flowed freely from her mouth. Just when I thought I could not hold back my seat any longer, I felt a tap on my shoulder. Big D wanted my spot. Relieved, I stepped off the bed, allowing the little man to take my place. He yanked up his orange sleeves and mounted Estella's prone and waiting ass. "You ready for a chocolate surprise, slut?" he asked, slapping her butt cheek. Fat Bob pushed himself up onto the bed next, causing it to sag visibly to one side. Vern was forced to shift to the side in order to avoid being smothered by Bob's enormous belly fat. Estella worked Bob's tiny penis and balls with her hands while Maxwell punished her face. That's when I noticed it. I was slowly stroking my meat, gazing around the room when my gaze fell onto that unsettling beanbag chair. I'm not sure what caused me to pause on this dreadful thing or why I scrutinized its features, but I did. And there was something different. Weren't those eyes pointing off to the right before? Wasn't the mouth wide with mocking laughter? Of course not, because now the eyes stared straight ahead toward the bed and the furry gangbang participants. Now the mouth hung slack as if hungry? "You're not getting in there, D. Come on, give us a turn." My concentration was broken. Big D was still struggling to cram his thick, limp cock into Estella's butthole. The Cum Brothers were growing impatient. D hopped off the bed without protest. His head hung in shame. He turned away from the group and began to furiously work his pull, cursing the erectile dysfunction under his breath, slapping his bulbous cockhead in anger as the big orange girl hippo head bounced around loose on his own. Verge disengaged as well, leaving the Cum Brothers to take their respective places.
"This bitch is on fire,"
my new friend said to me. He was flushed, dripping with sweat, clearly enjoying himself.
"I've never seen a civilian this cock-hungry. Hell, half the porn stars I fucked aren't this into it. Remind me to get this bitch's number. I want to do this again. Mr. P, you listening to me?"
"What?" I said, back to scrutinizing the awful chair. "Oh, yes, she's fantastic. Better than I could have imagined."
"I gotta get back in there, but fuck, I gotta take a piss first."
He grabbed at his ornate penis.
"Hold my place in line, will you?"
"Sure," I said, not taking my eyes off the chair.
"And don't come too fast, you old fuck."
He laughed and walked away. I did not respond.
"I'm sorry,"
the party creep said, stepping in front of Vern.
"But there's no leaving the room once the party has begun."
"The fuck you want me to do, piss in here?"
Vern said, easily sidestepping the squat, froggish man. Before he could say another word, Vern was out the door. I took my attention away from the beanbag chair long enough to see that a look of apprehension had crossed the little man's face. He checked his watch again, obviously worried about something. But what? The Cum Brothers were pounding Estella's swollen flesh holes. They seesawed back and forth with blinding speed while Maxwell punished the poor girl's mouth. He'd wrapped both hands around her faux dreadlocks and was currently using them like reins to pull her head forward while ramming his big fake cock down the woman's throat. Her eyes watered, causing the purple makeup to smear and run in such a way as to suggest tears of blood running down her pretty face. She gagged and gagged as orgasm after orgasm racked her lithe body. "You like that shit, you little teddy bear, huh? Growl for Maxwell. Growl for the big scary lion, bitch." My erection was throbbing. I would not be able to hold back my own orgasm much longer. I was about to cut in on Maxwell for some of that sweet oral action when I chanced one last look over my shoulder. I froze, startled. Genuinely and without question, that creature of a chair had moved forward 4 or 5 feet. There was no doubt something very, very weird was going on. My sexual urges left me. In their place grew unease and fear. This bizarre party was not what it seemed. These people, Estella and her squat companion, were not what they seemed to be. But then what were they? Just then the party planner lurched forward.
"It's time, Stella. The moon is right."
I hadn't noticed before, but there was an enormous picture window at the western wall, towering above the bed. The drapes were drawn, and I could see the moon, huge and full, directly through the center of the window, casting its light into the room, lighting up the bangers like a spotlight. Estella pulled Maxwell's cadaver dick out of her mouth.
"Everybody get on the bed."
She climbed off the Cum Brothers and onto her knees.
"I want everyone's cock touching my face right now. Fucking come on me. Everybody come all over my fucking face."
Big D jumped up and joined the other four. Vern had yet to return from the bathroom. but I wouldn't move. I couldn't. Something had changed. The boys took no notice, each of them smacking their wet dicks off Estella's face. She sucked them, stroked them, frantic motions, eager to taste their liquid. Every last one of them was drunk with lust. They didn't see what I saw. Oh, God, they didn't hear what I heard. It started so low, I thought it had come from someplace else in the house. The sound, it was like dozens of children singing. It was slow and methodical, like a schoolyard rhyme. I couldn't make out the words yet, only the melody. I didn't realize it was coming from inside the room until I saw them move. The headboard, it came alive. The plushy dolls, the bunnies, the kittens, the puppies, and all the rest. The damn thing started to dance. Why? Why didn't anyone else notice this madness? The toys were somehow alive, and none of these people seemed to care. Fat Bob was the first to come. He leaned back so as to get as much of his belly away and as much of his diminutive cock forward as possible. He furiously tugged away with two fingers and a thumb. He stood, pudgy legs spread wide, just behind the crouched Estella, so that when his little pecker shot off, two thick, pearly ropes of jism landed cleanly across her forehead. She moaned with delight, crossing her eyes in an attempt to see the splooge adorning her face. Big D was next. He climbed up Bob's expansive stomach and perched above Estella's prone face. He spit on both his hands and began to rhythmically corkscrew them across the purple tip of his giant wang. He closed his eyes in stern concentration. After several strokes, he grunted. Out of his ridiculous cock shot two dual streams of thin, milky spunk. They hit the woman directly on the nose and splashed back a little onto her cheek before oozing down onto her open lips. She eagerly licked it away. But something was very wrong. The stuffed animals continued to dance and sing, the melody growing louder. And Estella's face! There was no doubt that it looked amazing as it was continuously splattered with cum rocket blasts, but it was somehow changing. It seemed to sink back further into the mouth of her bare head, to somehow grow dimmer, less defined as Maxwell stepped forward. He yanked, almost violently, against his cadaver dick, up and down, left and right, the vibrating dildo buried deep inside his vagina, sounding on the verge of death as he pushed so hard. Then, all at once, as he was overcome with orgasm, he pushed a button at the base of the dead balls attached to his cock. A small cascade of sperm unloaded into Estella's right eye, sealing it shut instantly. That's when the chant of the damnable toys that danced and sang with complete immunity from the people around me grew loud enough to understand. Moonlight wakes us from our sleep, pulls our thoughts from the ancient deep. Hunger calls, our duty pledged. We spill our seed across your heads, and with our tools your blood be shed. Feed our masters with our own kind. Now is time, our pledge we bind. How could they not hear it? It was so loud now. The Cum brothers stepped up, one on either side of Estella's head. The rest of the group stroked their flaccid cocks in anticipation for the grand finale. Estella, too, eagerly watched the two big dicks with her one open eye, stroking their shaved balls with her paw hands. The two chiseled hunks matched each other's strokes perfectly. They were artistic geniuses. Estella's messy face, their canvas. Their beautiful cocks shot off at the same time, and yes, it was glorious. Their pearly white manjuice was impossibly thick as it splashed down onto the woman's waiting cheeks and tongue. Blast after blast assaulted her mouth. I counted 7 full spasms, each one arching higher into the air. Consistency so thick, none of the jism splashed off onto the bed. What Estella couldn't catch with her mouth stuck to her face like glue. Even after the initial orgasm had finished, their cocks twitched and dripped, globs of goo, which Estella licked away with a delighted grin on her totally slimed face.
All right, and we're back. That was Cotton Candy Part 3.
The sexy part,
shit,
yeah.
Got into the nitty-gritty.
And thanks, if you're still listening to us, thanks for being patient with this long episode. We had to get a little off our chest.
For sticking around. This is for the over-the-road truck drivers.
Yeah.
This is for the people who spend 5 hours a day commuting back and forth to work.
Or can listen at work or whatever.
Yeah, we appreciate you sticking around. I did not mean to rant that long. I'm impassioned, gang. I get really upset about these things because I, again, I don't get mad and angry and mean about things because I'm not successful. I get mad and angry and mean about things because I'm disappointed in other people. I thought I was entering into a writing community where I could talk about, well, off the air, Jeremy and I were talking about martial artists and how martial artists, if they want to be the best, they have to push themselves in their martial arts. It's not about who they're hanging out with, having beers with after the fight. It's about how devastatingly they can beat ass in the cage. And as a writer, all I care about is writing the most devastating sentences I can onto a piece of paper. And the fact that every writing community I've tried to belong to has disappointed me by virtue of the fact that they don't care about writing the best sentences they can on paper. They care about who they're having beers with at the bar afterwards has always disappointed me. And I found a few. There are several authors. Like when last year when I went to the Oregon coast and wrote a book with Carlton Mellick, it was one of the coolest experiences for me as a writer because that dude wants to talk about writing the best sentences he can on a piece of paper. And we got to spend hours talking about the writing process. It was literally like meeting your favorite, if you're a martial artist and you got to meet your idol, and he ended up only wanting to talk about martial arts the whole time, and all you did for hours and hours upon hours was sit and break down ideas for how to be better fighters.
It'd be like meeting one of the Gracies and them talking about the intricacies
of all of the of different moves, man. Yeah. And wanting to open up their mind to you and allow you to ask them, well, how did you come up with the idea for this move? And they answer you. Mm-hmm. And they're passionate about it and they care. You know, I remember, were you with me when we saw up in Chicago when we saw the 35mm print of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead?
Yeah.
Do you remember how passionate that guy was about answering the same questions he's answered for 40 years?
It was like he never got that question. And they were questions that you know he's got over and over and over.
Longer than I've been alive, he's been answering those questions.
Yeah.
And he answered them like he was so excited to be there. And that was so inspiring to me. And I remember talking about it with you afterwards that, like, that motherfucker still has it. Because you'll meet certain idols that just don't give a fuck. They don't give a fuck. Did you pay me already? Did you already give me the $20? Like, they only care about getting paid and going on
the way. Yeah, I was amazed. I mean, it was the simplest questions, and it was like he never got them. But there's no way in hell, as long as that movie's been around, that he hasn't got those questions. Now, it was the first time those people got to ask him those questions, but you know he's answered it in probably 1,000 times a piece, minimum.
And his answers weren't canned at all. They were very passionate, super passionate.
No, he seemed in it.
And so you just know, like, when you're in the presence of a guy like that, you know he's in the right. Like, he's doing what he should be doing. He's doing what he was put here on this earth to do. He's not phoning it in. He hasn't lost his passion. And for people who, again, who think that the only reason that I go off on these fucking crazy rampages and tangents is because I'm somehow not fulfilled or successful, it's exactly the opposite of that. I get mad at people because they won't reach their full potential.
I'm cutting you off. News. These motherfuckers waited for the news. We're going to give them the news.
All right. Well, we didn't even talk about part three of the gangbang.
The gangbang. The sexy stuff.
Stella. Is it Estella or Stella?
I think it's Estella.
Is it Estella?
I think so.
What the fuck her name is?
Estelle.
Yeah. She gets gangbanged. Mm-hmm. We have a nice... We already met our little cast of characters, but they all have their own little intricate ways that they bang. Mm. And we go through the whole process. They put the furry costumes on. I was going to ask... We talked about this at the... Jeremy and I went to a concert together the other night, and we briefly talked about this, but I told him we'd talk about it on the show. Do you know where I first learned about the furry community?
CSI?
Yeah, CSI. the television show CSI is where I think most of America first learned that there was
definitely the most people in one situation that found out about that.
Yeah, that found out that there was a community of people who like to dress up as furry animals and then have sex with each other in group orgies.
Yeah.
Very bizarre community. And
Scritching, I believe is what they called it.
I wanted to write a werewolf story, but I wanted to do it in a way that I didn't think it had ever been done before. And
pretty sure that's not been done before.
And did we talk about on the origin of Cotton Candy Show? The Skinwalkers. Yeah. So that's, I was like, what kind of people? I was like, well, furries put on costumes. What if it was like that? What if it was like that? So this is where, we get the costumes and we get the sex, and then right as they all, and I wrote a because you know the best part about watching the gangbang is the cum shots.
Yeah,
this is the 10 minutes of girls getting absolutely drenched in man goo. So I wrote a big, long, intricate scene with the cum shots at the end, and that's where we end this.
The climax of this episode.
That's where we end this.
Was the
right as Estella starts her transformation into episode 4. So, do we talk about the news, or do we talk about the news next week?
Let's talk about the news.
All right.
So, given what's going on this week,
there's a lot of things going on, man. I don't want to talk it for another hour.
Give half of them now. We'll give half the next time.
Well, what do you want to talk about? The biggest news, there's a few pieces of big news. Number one is my new novel, Beetle Brain, has been sent off to the editor, Sean Ferrari,
yep,
for his final edit. I expect that book to be released in June. And we are once again working with Will Scar, the
cover artist
who did I Died in a Bed of Roses, is coming back to do the cover for Beetle Brain. And he starts that in just a couple of days. He's got all of my initial details about what I want the cover to look like, and he's about to get started. So
awesome.
Brand new book, hopefully in June. If not,
just in time for Crypticon.
If not, early July, it will be done in time for Crypticon. Because Crypticon's late July, isn't it?
Mid-July.
It'll be done in time for Crypticon. So our very next convention appearance, Crypticon Kansas City, we will have brand new novel, Beetle Brain, along with all the other Strange catalog. I made an executive decision I don't think I've told you about yet.
I saw it on Facebook.
That we are skipping Indianapolis Horror Hound this time. Few reasons for that. I've been to Indianapolis a million times, and 99% of the fans that go to that show go to most of the other shows. In fact, most of the ones that we just met in Columbus or in Cincinnati, mm-hmm, are the same people that go to Indianapolis. Indianapolis is such a big show. For a regular table, they want $325. That's more than we paid for the wall space, mm-hmm, at Cincinnati. It's just outrageous. The table cost is outrageous. And there are so many other shows that happen right there in the Midwest. Kansas City, there's a show I want to do sometime. I think it might also be in September. I think it might be a couple weeks before that Horror Hound show is Days of the Dead Louisville. I love Louisville. Have you ever been to a Louisville show with me?
Yeah. It's the first show we went to. Galt House.
It was Louisville, right? Yeah, that was for Ken Daniels show. What is that show?
Big convention with all the different
Fright Night Film Fest.
No.
Yeah, it was Fright Night Film Fest, and then they had they call it something else also.
The film fest was there, but it's
it's some kind of Comic-Con thing.
Comic-Con convention. Yeah. Anime convention.
I love Louisville, and we haven't been to Louisville in years. That was years ago. That was like 3 years ago. So I didn't want to. If I had to compromise on one or the other, it's like, well, I already saw most of the people. Well,
we're going to Columbus anyway. So
and they're doing a Columbus show in November, and they've only done Columbus a couple of times. The Columbus show we did really well at. I think the last time they did it, I don't think they've done a Columbus show since. So I really was more interested. And that Columbus, those tables will be $200 compared to $325 in Indianapolis.
And we'll end up in Indianapolis next year, I'm sure. So.
There's just a lot of opportunities to go to Indianapolis. I've done it a million times. We want to do Flashback in Chicago. There's a bunch of shows I want to do. Can't do them all.
Yeah.
And why go do the one we've done a million times that we're going to see all the same people at the other ones anyway? So. That made a few people upset on social media. I don't know how to make it up to you. I don't know how to make it up to you. I don't know what I could do in Indianapolis to allow. I could try to set up a signing at a bookstore, but you're the only people that are going to show. It's going to be the three people upset that I'm not coming to Indianapolis. Are going to be the three people that show up. So I just don't know how to make it up. A few people told me privately that they can't get out of Indianapolis. They can't come to one of the other shows. I don't know how to make it up to you, but I'm going to try in some way. I feel bad, but it's just how it is. It's this. Yeah. We'll get you next year, I guess.
Yeah, we'll get you next year. Maybe we can do something special next year for
him. Yeah, I don't know what to do, but we'll figure it out. Huge news, and we'll close with this. Because it wraps us all back around. Pertinent to all of this that we've been talking about on today's episode. During my social media rampage, one of my social media friends, very famous, very successful author, very introspective guy, very fair guy, very honest guy, he told me there was a comment thread. I don't remember who started it. It wasn't him. It was another, maybe it was Spicoli. Maybe it was Spicoli, but I don't remember who started it. Someone suggested, because of how ragey and outspoken I've been about free speech lately, with all the Berkeley protests and whatnot.
We're going to Berkeley.
That, no. They suggested that I do a...
I just want to punch the man.
That I edit a free speech, a free speech themed anthology. I'm not editing in an anthology ever again. I cannot...
Publish?
I cannot deal with...
Because I don't think Sean wants to edit.
No. No, never again. Not interested in that at all. Never had fun doing those anthologies, dealing with authors in that way. This author, Craig Spector, he encouraged me in that thread. Yeah, you should do that. That's a great idea. He then contacted me privately a few days later and said, scratch that. I'm going to edit an anthology that's free speech themed. Well, Craig Spector, if you don't know who he is, with his writing partner John Skip, Skip and Spector were two of the most praised and talented horror authors of the late 80s and 90s. They helped usher in the splatterpunk era. They're considered two of the godfathers of splatterpunk horror fiction, which is what the splatterpunk sort of got a bad connotation over the years and sort of morphed and changed its name to extreme horror. It still exists to this day. Craig Spector is one of the godfathers of what is my extreme horror is one of my favorite. It's the bloodiest, goriest, most graphically violent, graphically sexual types of horror out there. And at the time when they started writing this, everybody was writing ghost stories and Frankenstein stories and vampire stories, very subdued. And they, as a reaction to the B-movie exploitation horror films of Sam Raimi, Peter Jackson, Stuart Gordon, Brian Yuzna, that ilk, these guys started writing the literary equivalent of that over-the-top, extremely graphic B-movie stuff. And so to have one of the godfathers of splatterpunk horror contact me and say, never mind, I'm going to edit my first anthology since they edited one of the coolest horror anthologies of all time called The Book of the Dead, edited by John Skip and Craig Spector. Craig Spector hasn't edited another anthology since. His next anthology is going to be called Freedom of Screech. And he asked me to be a part of it. And he personally invited me to be a part of it. Said that my rants about free speech on social media inspired him to edit the first anthology he's edited since The Book of the Dead. So... for all of you unbuddy system motherfuckers who think that the only way to inspire other authors, the only way to get invited to anthologies, the only way to have a presence in a community, in a presence in a writing community, is to kiss ass and be disingenuous and not push boundaries and not take chances, you're wrong. You're wrong. And I am living fucking proof that contradicts everything you motherfuckers talk about. You are trendy, vapid, shallow posers. And every one of you needs to look at yourself in the mirror today and ask yourselves, do you want to be a writer or do you want to be the fucking trendy cheerleader in high school? Because there's only one type of writer who's going to stand the test of time, who's going to change the course of literary history, who's going to be remembered for generations. who's going to inspire 50, 75 years from now, who's going to inspire that next generation of writers and filmmakers and artists and musicians. It ain't the kind of writer who's concerned about what hat is trendy or which political system is trendy right now. It's the boundary pushers, man. It's people willing to take chances and be real, be honest with themselves. So, with great pleasure, I get to accept this invitation to the Freedom of Screech anthology, edited by Craig Spector. And I hope, gang, that this episode is a lesson to you to be fucking real with yourselves. Quit being trendy, phony, social climbing posers on the internet. It ain't worth it. Not if you are a true artist. Got anything else to add to that?
No.
Jeremy Daniels?
No. I was hoping you were going to go to and keep reading.
Yeah. Remember, till next week, till the conclusion, Cotton Candy and a bunch more cool. Next week we're going to talk about the new project I'm working on, what inspired that, and who's involved.
Yeah.
In that project.
Yeah.
We're gonna save that till next week. Till then, gang. Keep
reading.
All music featured on the Reading to Strangers podcast provided by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/.